I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order, and today is February 5th. And I'm wondering if Representative Earhart or Representative Benson or Simonson has read the minute. Oh, I guess we don't have a quorum. We can't move the minutes yet. I apologize. So we're actually going to take up a Representative Detmer's bill first, and we understand that you have an author's amendment that you want to put on, but we don't have it. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, not on House File 67.
Maybe the next one?
Yeah, there's the delete all amendment on the next
one. We'll get to it. Okay. So with that, when we get a quorum, we can move the minutes, but Representative Myra is going to chair this committee, and so we'll get started with Representative Detmer. Welcome, and to your bill, Representative Detmer. We can't move it until we've got a quorum. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And House File 67, this information was brought to my attention last year by a constituent that has a business, and basically what the bill does, it makes three changes in the sales tax, administering the sales tax. In terms of increasing the filing threshold, and allows the business an average of over $14,000 or less on a monthly taxable sales to file and pay on a quarterly basis instead of monthly basis. And it also provides a vendor allowance for the retailers collecting the remitting the sales tax to the state. And then the third thing that the bill does, it requires the Department of Revenue to construct an address plus five digit zip code to look up for the sales tax around the state. This individual has a company that I think most of you have been to events where they have the blown up party events for children to play in, and he does business around the metro area, around the state, and wherever he goes there could be a different sales tax, and plus he has to hire somebody within his company to send the sales tax into the state. So basically what he's saying, I'm doing the work for the state. And so what this bill does, it gives him flexibility of when he needs to turn in the sales tax, which would be on a quarterly basis instead of a monthly basis. And but I've asked Pat Dalton here to maybe explain the bill a little bit more, and she helped me put this together. And also, you should also have a sheet showing what other states are doing regarding this, too.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research, and I'll just take you through the bill summary. The first section basically changes the threshold and at which you are required to file monthly returns. Currently, if you have liabilities of over $500 a month, you must file monthly, and this raises it to $1,000. The $500 a month was put in 1993 and has not been increased since 1993. Section 2 is just some technical cross-reference changes related to actually the vendor allowance in Section 4. Section 3, it basically allows the retailer to retain the vendor allowance. Section 4 is really the substance of the bill. It allows vendors to retain a portion of the tax collected as compensation for collecting the tax. There are currently 27 other states in the country out of the 45 that have sales tax that do allow some form of vendor allowance. The vendor allowance proposed in this bill is 3% of the tax collected up to a maximum of $90 per report. So if you report quarterly, you would the maximum you could collect would be $360. If you reported monthly, the maximum you could collect would be just under $1,000 or just over $1,000. And if you report annually, it would just be $90. There is a minimum if you are remitting less than $10 on your report, you get to keep the lesser of 3% of the tax, the actual tax paid, or $10. And finally, Section 5 requires the Department of Revenue to develop this free address plus five-digit lookup table. The constituent of Representative Detmers came in and he said, I don't know the nine-digit zip code for most of my customers, and they don't frankly know their nine-digit zip code. The current website does allow you to, the department maintains a current website that if you input the nine-digit zip code, It will correctly calculate the state and local taxes owed. It does have a one sentence at the bottom that says, if you don't know the nine digit, you can click on a link, which is not very prominent, and it will take you to the U.S. Post Office, where you can enter the address, and it will give you a nine-digit zip code, but then you actually have to take two steps to move it, because you can't move the entire nine-digit zip code. You can't just copy the whole nine-digit zip code and move it back into the Department of Revenue's website. You have to move it in the two parts. So this would actually require them to develop their own address plus five-digit zip code, so you wouldn't have to take those extra steps.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Appreciate that explanation. Notice that there is a quorum now, so we'll call this hearing to order. And Representative Runbeck, have you had an opportunity to look at the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I look at the minutes of January 24th and 29th and 30th.
Thank you. Are there any corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, Representative Detmer, do you have any witnesses or testifiers?
Mr. Brian Gilbertson mentioned that he might try to get here, but I don't see Mr. Gilbertson.
All right, thank you. Members, are there any questions? Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Detmer. I have a survey out with my constituents, and they would be thrilled if we had uniform sales tax everywhere. But I'm as probably representing the area that has probably the most layered number of local option sales taxes or state-imposed sales taxes, I can just tell you that the 55418 zip code crosses over into areas that are not subject to the Minnesota Twins Hennepin County tax. It also extends, it includes people who live in suburban communities are not subject to the City of Minneapolis Viking sales tax. And, you know, I understand the problem of consumers knowing their nine-digit zip code, but I don't know how easy it would be to program in all the complexity, even just in this one little zip code, where we are subject to lots of different laws that were passed by the state legislature.
Representative Detmer.
Well, what we were wanted to do, the one section of the bill would require Section 5, require the Department of Revenue to post that on their website so that a person could go put in an address and find out exactly what the zip code is, or what the zip code that is required, and what the tax would be for that area. That'd be Section 5.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Detmer, but I'm just saying that for all the businesses that were within this area, that would potentially be, I mean, it'd be nice to have it accessible, but they still have to have an internet connection. They still have to have an ability to enter that in, which I have to say for many of the small businesses that I deal with, particularly many of which are run by ethnic groups. We have a lot of wonderful, they say, see Northeast, see the world. We have food from all over the world. It's wonderfully tasty. We have ethnic grocery stores that I find it absolutely fascinating to see things that I wouldn't quite know how to use in cooking, but I'm tempted to try. And so I just think in terms of just the, we're still going to have some businesses, I think, who are going to struggle just because of just the access to the internet, the ability to work with the system, even if it's automated. And I'd still love to work with someone on a uniform sales tax proposal.
Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, well, the whole purpose of this bill is to help vendors out, because they are doing the work for the state and collecting the sales tax and sending it in on a monthly basis.
Yeah, they have.
We're just saying that instead of a monthly basis, we could send it in on a quarterly basis to help, because they have many of these small businesses, you know, put people to work and trying to figure out how much they're supposed to send in and keeping the books and so forth. So it's to help these small businesses out.
Representative Detmer, we have a quorum, so we can move your bill.
Somebody in the committee will, Madam Chair.
You want to move it or someone else?
I'll move it.
Thank you. Representative Hansen?
I'll move Representative Detmer's bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Laufer, did you have any other comment?
Nope.
Okay. Representative Loon?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Detmer, for bringing this bill forward. I think it makes a great deal of sense, and I often hear from business owners and small businesses in particular about sort of the complexity or the hassle, honestly, of collecting sales taxes and not having a vendor allowance for doing that collection for the state. Do you happen to know how many states do provide some kind of vendor allowance? Because I know other states do that.
Representative Detmer?
Madam Chair, Representative Loon, 27 states have some type of vendor allowance.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Detmer, or to our research staff, do you have any idea if compliance is enhanced at all through that allowance? I'm wondering if maybe, for businesses, that they're allowed a little bit of, honestly, money for their trouble, if that helps with compliance in the collection of those sales taxes.
Madam Chair, Representative Loon, I don't know that there have been any studies about that. However, one of the requirements that you have to meet in order to get the vendor allowance under this bill is that you have to be in compliance with all the sales tax remittance and reporting regulations.
Representative Loon.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I don't know if it's calculated at all in the revenue estimate or in that in looking at this, but I would think in looking at sort of the carrot approach versus the stick of noncompliance and failure to file, that may be, a better way to go about getting compliance and again, compensating, especially those very small businesses who often don't have an accountant or someone on staff. They're doing it themselves once the shop is closed for the day. So I think this is an important issue, and I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Representative Detmer, do you have any closing comments?
Well, just Madam Chair and committee, some of these small vendors, they travel around the state or they travel around different areas, and I think this piece of legislation will help them with their business and also realize what the different tax rates and the different cities have different sales tax rates, allow them to, do a better business for the state, make sure they get the sales tax money back to the state in a good timing manner. And I just think for small businesses, this will be a great asset.
Thank you. Members, we're laying this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Detmer, I understand you have another bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Rumbeck, will you move Representative Detmer's House File 71, please?
I will move it if that'll be of help.
Certainly.
Madam Chair, I do have you should have a copy of the DE2.
Happy to move the amendment as well.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Detmer, to your bill, please.
Yeah, with the DE2 amendment, it updates the bill for the changes that Congress made by the federal estate tax and the fiscal cliff legislation passed on January 2nd. This includes making new exemption for rules permanent, both to increase the dollar amount and the portable feature. Number two, it also adjusts the filing requirement for the states that do not have federal estate tax filing requirements and will also not have a Minnesota filing requirement. This was an oversight in the draft of the original bill that I had, and it also makes a technical correction in the limitation of the credit amount to make sure that the tax only applies to values over the exemption amount. And this is also apparent in the drafting oversight of the original bill. And I've asked Mr. Michael to come in and address the bill for the committee.
Representative Detmer, before we go ahead to hear that testimony, we would like to vote on putting the bill in the order the author would like. So all those in favor of DE2, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Mr. Michael, go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joel Michael from House Research. I'll just briefly describe the bill as amended. Essentially what this bill does is to adopt, really does three things. First of all, it adopts the new federal estate tax exemption rules for Minnesota estate tax purposes. So that will increase, that'll do two things. One, it increases the current $1 million estate tax exemption that Minnesota has, and it raises it to for people that die in 2013, it raises it to $5.25 million. And that amount is indexed in the future for inflation. So the dollar amount increases. Secondly, as perhaps many of you know, that exemption is a portable exemption, so that if you have a married couple and the first spouse dies, but there is not essentially the estate plan is not set up and the property ownership is not set up so that that first estate uses the full exemption. So let's say that they only use $3 million of the $5.25 million exemption. Under the federal portability rules, which these would bring into the Minnesota law, that unused exemption gets passed on to the surviving spouse so that the surviving spouse can use it when the second death occurs. So that's the first thing the bill does. It adopts these new federal exemption rules. Secondly, it repeals, in 2011, there were separate special exemptions enacted for farm and small business property that were up to $4 million. Since the $1 million plus the $4 million is less than the $5.25 million, this repeals those exemptions because the general exemption is now bigger than what those special exemptions were, so that would apply to everyone. The third thing is it requires you to file a state estate tax return only if you have an estate that's required to file a federal return. So if you're not required to file a federal estate tax return, you would not be required to file a Minnesota estate tax return.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Representative Detmer, do you have any other testifiers?
No, I went to the expert, and
all right.
That's what I did.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Michael, so basically what we did in special session in 11 was we went from $1 million added $4 million, so we're at $5 million in certain cases for farmers and small businesses. So this would replace us, not that. Now, with the bill that was just passed in Congress, isn't it $5 million per person?
Mr. Michael.
Representative Davids, yes, it's the estate is entitled to $5.25 million for the estate. And so so for a married couple, for example, each spouse would get that $5.25 million. And the thing that's different about this is that, you know, under Minnesota law and under old federal law, you had to be careful to make sure that you didn't waste that exemption when the first person dies. The thing that's different about this is that you could pass it on. So the second person could have a $5.25 million plus whatever they inherited from the first deceased spouse. So they may actually have a $7 million or a $10 million exemption.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Michael, so that mirrors federal law?
Correct.
Mr. Michael?
Right. Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions, members? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm probably the outlier here, but I've actually been a personal representative for two farm estates, and it's my understanding that where you're dealing with this, maybe Mr. Michael can help me, but what we're talking about here is the estates after you've settled everything else. So you have your expenses, you have any bills or debts that are out there that may be involved, and perhaps there's been an exclusion with gifting that's been to surviving heirs. So most people plan ahead because they know that, you know, there's never been a hearse with a U-Haul behind it. You can't take it with you. And so I believe that a $1 million exemption, really the current estate tax, is the most progressive thing we have in our tax code. And what happened in the fiscal cliff really just continues to shift the advantage towards the wealthy and their heirs, kind of like we were 100 years ago. And I think there's a benefit in progressivity, and this is a progressive tax the way it has. And when we start going up and talking, we're going to spend a lot of time in the next few weeks or few months talking about pennies here and dollars there. We're talking millions of dollars here, millions of dollars of that you can't take with you. And so when we go through this progressive climb of exclusion of taxable income, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I may have some constituents that deal with that. The farm estates that I dealt with didn't have that. And we tend to rush towards things where large money is involved and argue about the things with the small money involved. And I think we should keep the estate tax where it is.
Representative Detmer, Mr. Michael, any comments on that?
Madam Chair, I will. Just to confirm what Representative Hansen said, yes, debts, any debts of the estate are subtracted, so it's the net amount that the tax is imposed on. So if you, for example, have a $5 million farm with a $3 million mortgage on it, only $2 million is included in the estate.
Representative Detmer?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just know that, there's a lot of... My family wouldn't fall under this, obviously, but I know there's a lot of families who have worked many years to establish their wealth or whatever it is, and it's many times they like to be able to pass it on to their family, to their members. I just felt that, that this is something the federal government thought was important. I thought maybe the state of Minnesota should follow.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope members of this committee, as they always do, are paying great attention, because I'm a firm believer in what Representative Detmer is trying to do here, because if you think about it, people have paid taxes on all the money in their estate already. And to me, this is the most immoral tax of immoral taxes, because you're taking something that someone has earned and you're taking it. And the problem in the district that I'm so fortunate to represent is you have farms of 1,000 or 2,000 acres, and on paper, they're worth a lot of money. But it's not cash, and you can't get to it. So what happens is there'll be a death in the family, and then the family farm has to be broken up and sold off, or parts of it sold off, to pay a tax on something that's already had taxes paid on it. So I thank Representative Detmer for coming forward with this. I think this is a very fair way to go. I personally don't like the $5 million number. I don't think there should be one at all. Because think about what you're doing. You're taxing something that's already been taxed, and you're making businesses and farms sell off part of their assets to give to the federal government on money that's already had taxes paid on it. So thank you for bringing this forward. And can I get on this one with you? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Detmer.
I don't want to kill your bill.
No.
But
anybody can sign on, obviously. But I just would like to thank the committee for allowing me to bring this up and present it to the committee.
Right. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Michaels, if you would just briefly refresh some of our memories about the recent legislation for exclusion for small business property and homestead farmland, whether that involves any personal property as well, including one's domicile and those kinds of things, or is it strictly in the case of farmland, the land and maybe the machinery and those kinds of things? What is the? I just don't remember the parameters.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, the qualified farm exemption applies to real property, so it would include the farmland and the homestead. It has to be land that's classified as agricultural homestead land. And the owner of it has, the decedent had to have that classification 3 years before death, and the qualified heir has to have it for 3 years after, has to continue that for 3 years after death. In terms of personal property, it does not apply to sort of the combines and the tractors and so forth, but they could qualify under the qualified small business exemption because a farm is a business, obviously, and if they haven't used up the full $4 million on the homestead land, they could also use it on the combine and the tractors and the planters and so forth, the personal property that way. But again, there's this three-year look back and three-year look forward. And sometimes the problems I think that get in, that are encountered is that you have multiple heirs and only one of them wants to continue farming, and so then you have the difficulty of how do you, you know, buy out the other, yeah, et cetera.
Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam.
Representative Hansen.
I just got a note for
Representative Davis. Oh, all right. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Representative Davis, I was just thinking about this. You used to be in the insurance business, including life insurance, I think. I don't know if you still are, but this is an enormous opportunity to provide liquidity to that farm unit or a business which also needs liquidity. So, you know, you should think about that before you cast stones there.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Davis.
I've made a lot of money protecting the folks.
Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps Mr. Michaels knows. Do we know how out of compliance Minnesota is on this issue? I mean, prior to the fiscal cliff being settled, where did we stand relative to other states? How many states were federally compliant, whereas we were not?
Mr. Michaels.
Madam Chair, Representative Rumbeck. By last count, I'm doing this by memory, so I may be wrong about it, but there, I believe that there are 30 states that do not have either an estate or an inheritance tax, and so federal, you know, sort of matching the federal exemption is not an issue for them. I believe three of the states that do have estate or inheritance taxes do have the same exemption amount as the federal. I believe it's North Carolina, Hawaii, and Delaware. And I think that Illinois, I'm not positive about this, but I think Illinois may be moving up, but they're not there now. So I think the right answer to your question is 30 states don't have estate or inheritance taxes, and three with have an exemption that matches the federal exemption. Mm-hmm. Two of the states that have inheritance taxes, Indiana and Tennessee, have enacted legislation that's phasing their tax out, but it's particularly in the case of Indiana, it's a very slow death because it won't go away until 2021, I believe.
Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Michaels. Good memory there. I want to thank Representative Detmer for bringing this bill. I mean, it's another example of Minnesota being one of those states that it becomes easier and easier for people who have succeeded and built a business, you know, with their own sweat equity and their own investments, to say, you know, for what I save by being in another state, I could build a new home. I could go to Florida, I could go to Arizona, I could build a brand new house and live there, because Minnesota is very, very punitive. And looks like we're going to continue to be, unless we actually would decide to increase the threshold.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, I came in late, so maybe I can clarify something. This question might have been answered, but isn't this about inheritance estate tax?
Representative Detmer.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I don't know how you're going to go build a house in a new state if you're dead. But Last time I checked, you can't take it with you. We might have changed that in the last legislative session. I don't know, but I have a question for Mr. Michael. Mr. Michael, how many people in Minnesota, what percentage of Minnesotans would this change affect?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, it varies from year to year depending upon the financial profile of the folks that die, but I think the general national rule is that about, the Department of Revenue estimate shows that it would affect about 800 to 1,000 returns, but of course the difficulty with that is that it varies from year to year depending upon, you know, who dies in a relatively mild, small, modest-sized state like Minnesota. Nationally, I think the number is about 0.7% of a state's end up paying federal estate tax. In Minnesota, the number is more in the 2-4% range. So in expressing that in percentages of estates, that's probably a good rule of thumb that this would reduce it from over 2% down to just under 1%.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Michael, can you tell me, is there anyone in my district that has this terrible problem having too much money when they die?
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I'm not that. That I cannot answer for you.
Okay, and I apologize, Representative Detmer. You know I liked you. I'm just being facetious, so that's what I do. But I just don't understand your philosophy. You Republicans, you talk about working hard, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, but then you talk about people being taxed who actually didn't work for any of it. They're getting handed on to them. That's what we do in this country. We don't have an aristocracy where you hand on these huge landed estates, and that's part of the principle of it. Now, I understand, Representative Davids, you got a family farm, and it grows, and it gets bigger, and you reach the point where you plan on having it, and it's all of a sudden you've got the unfortunate benefit of having it be so worthwhile that you got to parcel it off upon a death. I understand that. I can see it. But that's still wealth. So we just got a basic difference in philosophy here, I think.
Representative Detmer.
Well, you know, when I talk to people, I consider myself as a Minnesotan and an American. I try to stay from the Republican and Democrat point of view on something like this. And I know my grandfather came from Germany when he was 14 years old, came in and worked on various farms through North South Dakota, and then finally homesteaded our farm in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And my dad ran it until he ended up selling the farm and so forth. I just feel that this bill is an American bill, and that we hope that we can help people out that have worked many years to establish themselves, and now and we're just following other states that don't have an estate tax at all, or as Mr. Michael pointed out, many states are starting to abide by the federal law. So that's where I'm at, and I like you too. So,
Representative Mellon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Representative Lesh asked the exact question I was going to ask, which is if we had any numbers on how many estates in Minnesota this would actually impact. And the reason I had thought of that is because I remember last year, Representative Detmer, when Governor Dayton had the millionaire tax proposal where we would only tax the income of people making over $1 million or more a year. And the runs for those numbers in my county and all of St. Louis County, Duluth, the Iron Range, up to the Canadian border, there was only 68 actual people that fell into that category, and that was $1 million. So I would imagine that the numbers we're talking about here would be even a lot fewer. So it sort of brought to mind, and I know obviously right now there's coming out a lot of different ideologies that we have here on this committee, but I was thinking about the commercial that I think maybe President Obama had during the last campaign cycle where somebody crawls up a ladder, and when you get to the top, do you pull up the ladder behind you, or do you leave it down for others to be able to crawl up the ladder too? And I'm sort of the philosophy that we leave that ladder down for others to be able to crawl up too. So, you know, I know we're having good discussions here, and we all sort of have different values and philosophies, but I think it's important that, you know, we do have a progressive tax code in this state so that others are able to climb that ladder, too. So, thanks.
Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Some of these questions just brought up another one, and that is, you know, I'm probably not in that top 1% either, but it seems that if one were to achieve that level, one would have done some significant estate planning. And I'm just wondering, Mr. Michaels, if you have any numbers on how many people actually have paid, not the 2% who might qualify if they had not done adequate estate planning.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, those numbers are largely the people that end up paying the estate tax, that it's about a little, in Minnesota, I think it's a little over 2% of estates end up paying. There's a larger number that file, but particularly when it's the death of the first spouse, if they leave, there's an unlimited marital deduction, so if you leave it to the second, you know, to the surviving spouse, there's no tax at that point.
Right.
And the other thing about the Minnesota estate tax, because there is no Minnesota gift tax, and there's no gift in contemplation of death rule, you can actually avoid the Minnesota tax if you're on your deathbed and you know you're on your deathbed to give your estate away before you die. That actually avoids the tax, and I'm sure there's some of that goes on, but in general it's about, you know, it's in that range of 2% or a little more than that end up paying Minnesota tax.
Representative Benson.
Just a quick follow, you may not have the numbers, but do you have any hard numbers on how many actual estates in Minnesota have paid it? As far as numbers, that's a percentage, but as far as hard numbers?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I don't have that, but I can get it from revenue for the last few years.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, ma'am.
I do not see any other questions. Members, we are going to be laying this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill as amended by DE2. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could, while we're switching out authors here, for Chairlain Chesky, just a question. I was really disappointed Thursday that we didn't get to meet. I had a whole bunch more questions for Commissioner Franz and other members on my side of the aisle did, too. They've contacted me. Will we be able to have Commissioner Franz back to continue the questioning? It'd be
Chairlain
fun.
Chairlain Chesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Davids, yes. And I did ask the Commissioner and his staff to make contact with the folks who were still on the list so they could get an immediate answer. And we provided the names that I had read into the microphone. But I really want to ensure that the committee gets the language. And it, you know, it's difficult to discuss, say, the LGA formula when we didn't have it. So it felt like we were getting to the point where we needed some more details. So yes, and I don't know when that is, but Representative Carlson would be able to tell us, and maybe you can recall. But there is a deadline that all the departments have to provide language by, and I'm not sure.
Okay.
Probably another 10 days or something. I think about they have, but fairly soon it's gotta get produced. So we should have everything in bill form.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Anderson, House File 206. Representative Anderson, will you please move your bill?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 206 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, to your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this legislation came out of a visit that I had this summer in my legislative district. I represent the area of Plymouth, and we have a lot of these nondescript light manufacturing buildings throughout the community that you always wonder what's in those places. Well, I got a chance through the Minnesota High Tech Association to visit one of those businesses and found out that here in this small building, they are making a plastic out of corn byproduct, and they have developed it to the degree that it can withstand the heat, and they've addressed all the problems that we've had with production of plastic out of corn in years past. Quite remarkable, very innovative, and impressive. When I had a chance to sit down with the people involved with this innovation, I asked them, I said, well, you know, what do you think about Minnesota's R&D and our Angel Investor Tax Credit and all these programs that we have designed to help you to make sure that you can continue your innovation here in the state of Minnesota? And one of the concerns that they expressed to me is that it's rather difficult to sometimes participate in these programs because of some of the hoops and that we put before them and the number of paperwork that we do and so forth. So I went back to staff and I asked them, I said, what can we do to make this even better? Because we want to make sure that Minnesota continues to be a state of high innovation. We are blessed with many great companies, but I think that we've read in recent news just yesterday that some of these businesses are struggling to stay here in the state of Minnesota, and that, of course, harms our ability to provide high-paying jobs in this state. These are where a lot of our engineers go and our great inventors. So that's the kind of the gist, the impetus for this piece of legislation. And I also brought with me the Minnesota High Tech Association is here to lend their support to it as well, and I'd like to give them an opportunity to speak to this bill too. But perhaps before we do that, if staff wants to kind of walk through the technical aspects of it, I thought we could maybe do that as well if that's helpful to members, Madam Chair.
That would be helpful. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what House File 206 does is to break the research credit into two parts. The first tier of the credit would be a credit that applies to all qualifying research in Minnesota at the 10% rate on the first $2 million of research that the business does. And then the excess over that, or over what's called the federal base amount, the current rules would apply where it's a 2.5% credit. Now, the important thing to note about that is that the federal credit, which our credit is currently based on, is an incremental credit. So the credit's only allowed to the extent that the business spends more on research than their base amount. And this base amount is determined under the federal rules that look back into the 1980s and look at how much the business spent on research back in the 1980s, unless, of course, it's a startup business that wasn't in business at that point, in which case a percentage of their gross receipts are deemed to be their base amount. So what this bill does is it says rather than basing it on that base amount for the first $2 million, you're going to get a 10% credit on your Minnesota research. Fairly simple concept. The other thing that's going on, because of the way the federal base is calculated, a business can never get the credit on more than half of its research expenditures, and this would eliminate that. So it's the combination of the fact that the base is gone and that 50% limit is off that both, as Representative Anderson indicate, makes it a simple concept for businesses to understand, but it also increases the amount of the credit that they will receive.
Madam Chair.
You. Representative Anderson.
And if I could, the High Tech Association is here to speak to the bill as well, as if that's all right.
Please introduce yourself and give your name for the record.
Sure. My name's David Minkinen. I'm a chair of our MHTA Government Affairs Committee. I've been chair for about 8 years of this committee, and I'm also a partner at Deloitte, so I certainly bring a commercial experience to the table too. You know, by the looks of the audience today, it looks like our citizens in Minnesota are a little more concerned about their guns than their taxes, but obviously taxes are very, very important for our companies and people in Minnesota. Maybe a little bit about MHTA, just so you have a perspective of kind of who we represent, is it's a 350-member organization. We represent small, medium, large businesses. Just to give you a couple examples, you have a little perspective, 3M, IBM, Ecolab, Medtronic, so very large companies, all the way to the smaller firms like Digital River, that's, you know, in my area where I come from, in Eden Prairie. As Representative Anderson said, you know, we're very, very fortunate to have the economy that we do in Minnesota here. We have 19 Fortune 500 companies based here, which is the highest percent per capita in the United States. We have many small, medium-sized companies that feed those Fortune 500 companies. And it's also a very diversified economy. with emphasis that we have in retail, manufacturing, healthcare, medical devices, agriculture, and up north where I'm from, timber and taconite. Each one of these companies in these areas, whether they're small, medium, or large, or even the one Representative Anderson mentioned, rely on significant research and development activity to innovate, create products, and create high-paying jobs and high-skilled jobs. On average, these jobs pay about $80,000 per year, so that the types of jobs that we want to have in our economy, it'll generate other taxes for us as well that we can do other things with. I would submit to the committee here that in today's global economy, we operate in a very, very competitive market with other states, other countries. They're all trying to create jobs and trying to come up with policies that encourage innovation, that create high-skill, high-wage jobs. And in the future, as we look to the future, location isn't as important as it used to be. And a lot of this work is done in a very virtual environment, where actually maybe, you know, innovation is done in another country that may be done for a company here in town. So location and bricks and mortar are not as critical as it has been in the past. And as companies do evaluate these alternatives, they do look at incentives like an R&D tax credit to determine where they're going to perform that activity, where they're going to locate that activity, and where those jobs are going to exist. And I would just encourage the committee, in order for us to stay competitive, we need to create state policies that incentivize these companies to create that innovation and create those jobs here in the state of Minnesota. And with that, you know, I'll take some questions, but our members do support this bill and encourage you guys to move forward with it.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Anderson, I kind of remember that we did this in the recent past, that we increased the R&D credit. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. When we did this, or maybe Mr. Michael can address this, that we did it. But what I'm really interested in is knowing whether we put in law some kind of outcome measurement, because I know that the statutes require us to do that when we do some kind of new tax exemption or credit or something. We're supposed to put in law a way to measure the effectiveness of that. And so if Mr. Michael can let me know if we did that, and if so, you know, what was that?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, in the 2010 legislative session, the first tier of the credit rate was raised from 0.5%, or from 5% to the 10% rate that you see, and the credit was made refundable. I think it was, and that was done in the jobs bill. I think the provision that you're referring to that requires the new tax expenditures passed in the omnibus bill of 2010, and so this was one that was enacted just before that requirement was enacted into law, but that's the way I recall it.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Mr. Michael, I thought we had done that before 2010. I'm kind of surprised to hear that, because I really did think we had done that earlier, but nevertheless, so that is in law, though, if I'm understanding you correctly, that we're supposed to do that now. It would be working, so that would apply to this legislation at least. And so I'm wondering, Representative Anderson, if you are going to do that. I don't see that in your bill here, and if you have maybe Mr. Michael can remind us what it actually requires in terms of a purpose statement or an outcome statement or something, and then I'm interested in knowing if Representative Anderson comply with that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling, for the question. People, in order for the businesses to qualify for this tax credit, they had to have already performed the R&D, so there are performance measures in place. So they don't get the credit unless they've actually performed the R&D. So that's already there.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I think that by, and maybe Mr. Michael can remind me what the legislation actually said, but I think that we need more than that. I don't think that would really meet the requirement, but maybe I'm wrong.
Mr. Michael
could answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, what my Pat's looking it up, but what my recollection is that the requirement requires that a newly enacted or expanded tax expenditure have a purpose statement that indicates what the purpose or intent or goal is of the provision, and then does have a measurable outcome that can be tested against. So on a bill like this, I think a natural thing to do would be to say, depending upon what the author intends exactly, and typically what's been done with these is that these statements have not been written until the provision actually gets incorporated into the omnibus bill. And then there's been some unevenness in doing that. But a typical thing would be to say, well, the goal might be to increase research spending in Minnesota, and that will be tested by measuring whether that happens, or to employ more people in research in Minnesota or something like that, and then test that by measuring it against what would have happened without this. And of course, the challenge with any of these things is what economists refer to as the counterfactual. You never know what would have happened if you hadn't done it. And so determining what the effect of it is always involves a certain amount of uncertainty. But that's the general concept, is that you set a goal and then have a way to measure against it.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, yeah, thank you, Mr. Michael. And so I guess we'll have the actual language of the legislation, but of the law, I should say. But we're going to need a measurable outcome here, because, of course, when we do tax expenditures are spending. And if we were going to have an appropriation to do something like this, we would want to know that we were spending money on something that was actually going to work and have a way to measure that. So, Representative Anderson, I assume that if this goes forward, it would be great if in the tax committee, when we're discussing the bill, if we would know what those measurable outcomes were intended to be. And, you know, I think maybe by the time it goes in an omnibus bill, it's kind of too late. It would be good if we could talk about that here in the committee. But anyway, maybe you'd like to just comment.
Representative
on
Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I'd like to have the MHTA to discuss this a little bit, because he has some historical perspective on this issue that I think will put you at ease.
Mr. Mickinson, is that right?
Minkinen. It's a tough finish
I'm
name.
I'm sorry.
North, that's okay. Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, my understanding of kind of the history of this is there's always been performance measures in the existing legislation. This existed prior to 2010. And in 2010, the major changes that happened in 2010 were just changes to the credits and how they were calculated, and the percentages were modified. But this legislation has been there, and there's always been, you know, performance measures. As Representative Anderson indicated, you have to actually perform the R&D before you get the credit. And the only thing that was modified in 2010 was the actual credits and calculations.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I think there's a kind of a disconnect here between what I'm saying and what the two testifiers are saying. It's not whether R&D gets performed. It's whether more R&D was performed than would have been without the additional credit. That's really the issue we're talking about. So that's what we mean when we say, you know, by spending the extra money on additional credits, are we getting something for our money above what would have happened anyway?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling, for that question. I think what we're seeing on overall on both our R&D and our angel investor tax credits that we have in place is that there is a huge need and desire for these resources to help grow businesses and, in particular, grow jobs in the state of Minnesota. In fact, we have a need here to fill of 188,000 STEM-related jobs need to be filled in Minnesota by the year 2018. That's a great problem for this state to have, because that means that we're going to have, on average, $80,000 per year salary jobs for individuals. So when our kids go and they enter into an engineering program at either University of Minnesota or any of the MinSCU systems, they're going to have a job when they graduate from college. And I think that's key, and I think this is one way that we can make sure that we're growing jobs in the state of Minnesota now and into the future.
Mr. Mickinen.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, members of the committee, if I could just maybe just elaborate a little bit on what Representative Anderson said, is I do think it has increase significantly the number of investments in these startups and these smaller companies. And certainly we can get some more specifics for you that we could share with Representative Anderson. She could share back. But I'll give you a personal story myself. This just happened in January. I personally made a significant investment in a food products company that has a very innovative technology in the way that pizza is cooked. And I wouldn't have made that investment if it wasn't for the angel investor tax credit. And this is something I'm doing, obviously, outside of my current job. But I think there's other examples like me that were out there that this wouldn't have happened if you didn't have some of these policies in place at the state. And this just happened, like, in the last month.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Mencken, well, I think, you know, the tax was doubled and made more generous 2 years ago as part of a jobs package. And I think the key question for Minnesotans is how many Minnesota-based jobs were created since 2010 as a result of this? Not investors like yourself who are investing in, you know, a new pizza technology because we've hedged your bets with the angel tax credit, but in terms of the R&D credit, you and your testimony indicated that, you know, it's possible to send out R&D for a company to invest its R&D in other states and other countries, even though they're based here. That would still qualify, as I understand it, for the credit. But the purpose of the increased investment in 2010 was to create Minnesota payroll jobs. And if you don't have the answer now, I would really like your association to poll its members and actually establish baseline measures before the credit was changed, and then where are we at now in terms of new R&D jobs located within the city of within the state of Minnesota? Because before I can feel comfortable stepping up with an additional $46 million a year in tax breaks for this valued part of our economy, I need to know that it's going to have those kind of ripple effects that we expected when we stepped up in 2010 with a much enhanced credit. And I think that's the question that we're wrestling with, is what can we see in terms of real measures that say those $79,000 jobs were created in Minnesota and they've been sustained over the past 2 years, as opposed to the company decided to invest in R&D internationally at a campus in another state. And, you know, what is the permanent employment impact that we invest from that result?
Mr. Mikkonen.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. I don't have that data with me right now, but I can compile that data and share it back with the committee.
Great.
Representative Loeffler?
That would be very helpful.
Chair Lancheski.
I'll pass.
Representative Zellers.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Anderson and Mr. Mencken, I read someplace, I think, that California has something similar to this, and you're going from 2 to 2.5%. Are you familiar with what the California, I think the number was, and if it was part of your testimony when you started, I apologize, but I think it was 15% in this credit. I'm not sure, maybe Mr. Mencken or Representative Anderson, climates, we have an idea of where they're at.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Zellers. We're going from 5% to 10%, and on the first tier is what we're basically doing on this piece. And what is, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to have the Department of Employment and Economic Development come today, and I don't know if you guys have ever had them come out to your district, but they always come out to my district, and we get to see some of these innovative companies. I happen to have McQuay International, that's in my district, do incredible things, innovation and high-paying engineering jobs. And what is helpful for me to hear from Deed in particular is that we are competing with other states and keeping businesses in the state of Minnesota. In fact, when I was first elected in 2006, I had an opportunity to try and help out a business. It was a med tech company, a small operation, but they got lured away by Michigan, and we couldn't compete with what we offered. At that time, we didn't have the angel investor tax credit, and thanks to Representative Dabney, he brought that forward, and I think that was wise of him to do, and I'm looking just to make sure that we can still keep these businesses in the state of Minnesota and hopefully attract some new ones. So,
Representative Zeller.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, and maybe Mr. Minkinen, some of those, I mean, obviously you're in the industry, so some of those competing climates that we are, to Representative Anderson's point, you know, if you have just a thumbnail, not necessarily a specific fact sheet, but what you're seeing around the country from a competitive standpoint, if we're keeping on par with, thankfully, with you know, some of the things we've passed, and, you know, Representative Dabney's bill in the past, which was good, we all voted for, how are we keeping up from a competitive standpoint?
Mr. Mickinen.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, you know, the 2010 modification certainly closed the gap. I mean, prior to that, there was a big competitive gap, I think, from Minnesota as you compare it to Massachusetts, California, some of these other states that we are talking about. We actually do have that data. I don't have it with me. I'll share it back with the committee. But a lot of the states that we are competing against are around 10%, Massachusetts and others that and obviously, you know, they're very interested in our medical device industry and so forth. So we certainly did close the gap in 2010, but I think there's more work to go if you look at it from a peer competitive standpoint.
Representative Zellers.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for coming.
Representative Liebling.
Oh, Madam Chair, thank you. I wanted to see, Ms. Dalton found the statute that I was referring to, and I just wondered if she could read that so we'd be clear on what it is.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the statute that Representative Liebling is referencing is Section 3.192, Requirements for New or Renewed Tax Expenditures. Any bill that creates, renews, or continues a tax expenditure must include a statement of intent that clearly provides the purpose of the tax expenditure and a standard or goal against which its effectiveness may be measured. For purposes of this section, tax expenditure has the meaning given in Section 270C.11, Subdivision 6.
Seeing no other questions, Representative Anderson, do you want to give some closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one comment for Representative Zellers. We did find out California is at 15%, so this would put us below them still. But and members, just appreciate your time today, and hopefully that you can support this as inclusion as part of the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Members, we're laying this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I refer House File 134, House File 173, and House File 208 to the Property and Local Tax Division. And seeing no other business, this meeting is adjourned.